It's Wednesday, October 27th, and your kid could get a COVID shot by next week. We start here. An FDA panel just paved the way for child vaccinations.
What we're hoping for are shots in arms by November 4th.
So how could that insulate the rest of the country? We'll ask whether we've turned a corner yet. The last time the Taliban was in charge, we suffered our worst terror attack ever.
They decided that they wanted to join something that was even more extreme.
Now the Pentagon says Afghan fighters could once again launch an attack on the homeland. And for the NHL, it's time for a gut check.
They said you have two options. One, you can resign, or you can do an investigation.
Why allegations against a coach are challenging preconceptions about sexual assault. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When COVID-19 vaccines started going into arms 10 months ago, it seemed like we had turned a corner as a country. Finally, we could protect ourselves and our families. We could hug a friend. We could even travel. We were promised a hot vax summer.
And it's July 4th. Let's celebrate our independence as a nation and our independence from this virus.
But for the last 10 months, while every adult could get vaccinated, not all of them did.
I don't agree with being vaccinated or wearing masks.
If I knew what I know now,
I would give a lot to be able to get that vaccine.
Variants made life for unvaccinated people even more dangerous than it was before. And all this time, nearly 50 million Americans still weren't eligible for a vaccine at all. I'm talking about children under 12.
But we are going to begin tonight with this major news on Pfizer's child vaccine.
Well, yesterday, an FDA advisory panel did something they have not done so far. They recommended authorizing a COVID vaccine for kids. And suddenly, after several moves from the government, people are wondering, could we finally be turning that corner that we were promised in the summer, just in October? Let's go straight to ABC's Ann Flaherty, who covers federal agencies. Ann, how significant was this move yesterday from the FDA?
Well, this is a big step in the right direction, but keep in mind this is an advisory panel. So they voted 17-0 with one person abstaining in favor of this vaccine for kids. So then that kicks it to the FDA. They go back and try to figure out if they're going to authorize this. All signs, all indications are that they are. Then it's got to go to the CDC. What we're hoping for are shots in arms by November 4th, around there, because the CDC director has to sign off.
We are actively working with pediatricians' offices to make sure that we are ready to go should that regulatory approval and the CDC recommendations come forward.
Really, this comes down to, you know, does the benefit of this vaccine for young kids outweigh the risk? And it's just, it's tough. You know, it's not a slam dunk that it was for seniors in nursing homes, for example. You're talking about kids that are relatively much less likely to get seriously ill.
I think the key thing to keep in mind is that there's millions of children who've gotten sick with COVID.
Now, when we do talk to pediatricians, one of the things that they talk about is, you know, kids are still getting really sick.
I work at a children's hospital. Our hospital has been full for the last month or so.
There's about 2 million kids in this age group have had COVID. About 8,300 have been hospitalized. And about a third of those kids had no underlying health conditions.
We don't want children to be dying of COVID, even if it is far fewer children than adults, and we don't want them in the ICU.
So COVID is now one of the top 10 causes of death for kids in this age group.
Wow.
And, you know, if you're a parent who's had a kid get really sick from this, it's enough to say, why don't we have the vaccines out already? Well, this is the first step in a process that means it's coming.
I think we have to very carefully monitor the safety profile of this vaccine going forward.
On the flip side, if you looked at the vaccine trials for these kids in this age group, no one who got the vaccine had any serious side effects, including myocarditis. But where this gets really tricky, though, is that the trial was relatively small. So you're talking about 2,000 kids getting this vaccine in the trials. Well, we're about to roll this out to millions of families. And I think that there is some nervousness by, you know, vaccine experts that there could be something out there that we don't know about. You know, there's always that risk, but this panel looked at it, said, we think that the benefits outweigh the risk because just too many kids are getting sick with COVID right now.
Wow, and so you'd think first week in November is very soon. And that wasn't even the only change in tune, I guess, from a federal agency yesterday, right? It's easy to forget, if you don't have family overseas, our borders have largely been closed to foreigners during this pandemic. When and how does that change?
So, you know, for a long time, the U.S. government was saying, basically going country by country and deciding whether or not people could come into the U.S. Well, we knew that they were going to change it starting November 8th.
Jean-Francois Drajan, he's been getting calls the whole day.
Within minutes, ready, as soon as we found out today, I had about 20 calls.
This week, we got our hands on the rules. Basically, foreigners traveling to the U.S. will be required to be fully vaccinated and to show proof. Now, it doesn't have to be Pfizer, Moderna, or J&J. Now, keep in mind, a lot of those vaccines aren't widely available around the world. It could be AstraZeneca, for example, which is widely used in Europe. It's anything that's been given the green light by the World Health Organization. So, you know, the Russian vaccine, no, that's not going to get you entry. There are some exemptions.
Children under 18, others coming from countries with limited vaccine availability, and people with documented allergic reactions to vaccines.
There are ways around it. So you're going to have to check those rules before you book your ticket.
Well, so then, and I mean, to hear all that, then it sounds like, you know, we're going to start accepting more people into the country. You know, families are going to be fully vaccinated as long as they're willing to. Are we turning that corner? I mentioned, like, how optimistic should we be that once kids are vaccinated, once these mandates kick in at workplaces, we finally do get to relax a little?
Well, you'd think, but I mean, haven't we been here before? I mean, this has happened before.
I was hoping you'd say something different this time.
Well, I mean, I think this is a really big step because while kids are less likely to get sick from the virus, seriously ill, they can get sick and they can spread it. That's a major contributor. You know, there's some health experts that are looking at the UK and saying those numbers are rising. We think it's being driven by kids.
It's passing on also to family members in the family unit, because a substantial proportion, about 50% of the kids, are without symptoms.
I don't think the pandemic gets behind us until parents vaccinate the kids.
I research water bottles, for crying out loud, for like 6 months. So let alone a vaccine, I do pause.
We have seen some hesitancy among parents. Even parents who vaccinate themselves might be less likely to vaccinate their kids because they have this belief, well, my kids are stronger than I am. They are less at risk.
A new survey finds that only about a third with children in this age group are saying that they will vaccinate their kids right away.
My strongest advice would be to listen to the people that you've always listened to with the help of your children. And I know that's what I did.
So, you know, that'll be interesting to see whether or not that vaccine hesitancy persists with that younger age group. That's going to keep the virus alive. And then keep in mind, there can always be another variant. And until we vaccinate the world, until these vaccines are widely available, we're at risk of another major surge. I don't think this is over yet.
All right, Ann Flaherty, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, when could the U.S. see its next big terror attack? Well, the military is betting it'll be earlier than you think. That's after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan about as quickly as you can imagine. It was quick, it was emphatic, and it was total. But it quickly became obvious that just because the Taliban were taking over the presidential palace, its grip wasn't ironclad.
Difficult news out of Afghanistan. A suicide bomb attack outside the airport in Kabul, and tonight the death toll going up.
The suicide bomb attack that killed nearly 200 people, including 13 U.S. service members. Remember, that was not a Taliban attack. That was an offshoot of ISIS called ISIS-K. And yesterday on Capitol Hill, Pentagon officials said ISIS-K is quickly ramping up its ambitions to the point where it could soon be attacking not just Afghan targets, but American ones.
We have considerable evidence that they have the intent. The question at the moment is the capability.
ABC's Louis Martinez covers the Pentagon. Louis, this was alarming, right? What do they mean when they say American targets? Like,
Like attacks on the homeland?
Brad, they're talking about either attacks on the homeland or maybe U.S. targets overseas. It's the wide range of possibilities that could be open for attacks by ISIS-K. So we should start off by explaining what is ISIS-K. That's the shorthand for ISIS Khorasan. Khorasan means Afghanistan, essentially. So this is the offshoot that operated inside eastern Afghanistan for years against the Taliban.
The Taliban and ISIS-K are mortal enemies. So the Taliban is highly motivated to go after ISIS-K. Their ability to do so, I think, is to be determined.
Actually, what happened was that many of these fighters were people who belonged to the Taliban. And when ISIS came around, they decided that they wanted to join something that was even more extreme, in this case, ISIS. So they rebranded themselves as ISIS Khorasan. They had maybe a couple thousand fighters. Many of them were struck or killed in fighting with the Taliban. Many of them were also put in prison by the Taliban.
When the Taliban swept through many cities, they also opened all the prisons. That didn't just include Taliban fighters, it also included ISIS.
I think the intelligence community currently assesses that both ISIS-K and Al-Qaeda have the intent to conduct external operations, including against the United States. But neither currently has the capability to do so.
The new information we have from U.S. intelligence is that ISIS-K is now regrouping and that within maybe 6 to 12 months, they may be strong enough to carry out external attacks outside of Afghanistan. That's because they're being allowed to regrow because they now have a safe haven, because they are no longer under constant Taliban attack maybe, or maybe even because the U.S. is no longer carrying out constant drone strikes against them.
And lots of unknowns, but, 6 months, that's not very far away. So what does the U.S. plan on doing? I mean, is the only option to, what are we going to do? Pay the Taliban? Pay the people that are not allowing women to go to school to dismantle this other group we don't like? What are the options?
Well, we know that the Taliban and the ISIS-K are mortal enemies, but U.S. officials say they are not going to rely on the Taliban to quelch ISIS-K from growing any further or from trying to launch attacks outside of Afghanistan.
That the Taliban was and remains a terrorist organization.
That's why the U.S. has been saying they had this plan in the works even before the Afghanistan withdrawal, what was known as
over-the-horizon capability that will allow us to keep our eyes firmly fixed on the direct threats to the United States in the region and act quickly and decisively if needed.
That meant that they were going to send up drones. They were going to use satellite intelligence, communications intelligence to try to determine if there was going to be a threat from ISIS-K or from Al-Qaeda, because they're still players in Afghanistan as well.
The Taliban is wary about Afghanistan being a springboard for Al-Qaeda external attacks.
If there was any threat against U.S. interests, either overseas or against the United States itself, then the U.S. military was going to carry out preemptive attacks launched by drones to take out any of these individuals involved in the planning.
The president will obviously be able to consult with others to see how we can effectively get aid to the people of Afghanistan without recognizing or maneuvering that funding at its core through the government.
So that's where the U.S. position is right now. And what you can really anticipate is that there's lots of monitoring going on right now to figure out exactly what ISIS-K is planning.
All right. Louis Martinez there at the Pentagon. Thank you so much, Louis.
Thanks, Brad.
When we learned about the sex abuse scandal in the gymnastics world with Larry Nassar or Penn State with Jerry Sandusky, it was easy to focus on how powerless these victims were. Many of them were children. But obviously, sexual assault does not depend on age or gender or strength. Recently, women's soccer has undergone a reckoning over allegations of sexual misconduct.
One of the happiest moments in the history of the Blackhawks when they won the Stanley Cup in 2010 was also a time when one of the players suffered a devastating sexual assault, he says.
And now in the National Hockey League, known as the home of the world's toughest athletes, a coach has been accused of sexually assaulting a player. Emily Kaplan covers the NHL for our partners at ESPN. And Emily, this alleged abuse is said to have happened more than a decade ago, right? How are we learning about this now?
Yeah, so in May 2021, a man who identified as John Doe, he was a former Blackhawks player, filed a lawsuit in Illinois, and he alleged that he was sexually assaulted by then a video coach of the Chicago Blackhawks during that 2010 Stanley Cup playoff run.
It's a goal, the Stanley Cup to the Chicago Blackhawks.
This John Doe at the time was 20 years old. He's what we call in hockey a black ace. So he was a minor league player just called up to the big team for that playoff run. And once this became public, the NHL obviously was concerned about it. And the Blackhawks said, we will commission an independent investigation. They hired an independent law firm, Jenner and Block, to conduct the investigation. That was led by Reed Schar. He's a former U.S. assistant attorney. And on Tuesday, that report was made public.
What does John Doe, I guess, allege happened back in 2010?
Yeah, that in May in 2010, there was a night of drinking with him and that coach, Brad Aldrich. They went back to Aldrich's apartment. And when investigators, they interviewed 139 people, including Brad Aldrich and this John Doe, they both agreed that a sexual encounter happened. Hmm. The discrepancy here is that Aldrich said it was consensual, while John Doe said it was not consensual.
John Doe recalled to us that he told Mr. Gary the details of the sexual encounter with Aldrich in full, that Aldrich was pressuring John Doe to have sex with him, and that Aldrich, the coach, told John Doe, the player, that if John Doe did not comply, Aldrich could harm John Doe's career.
According to the investigation, days later, a man named Al McIsaac, who is a very high-ranking official in the team's front office, was made aware that something might have happened.
There was a meeting that I've heard that was done in Chicago. I was not part of any meeting, and I was not part of any decision.
A couple days later, Al McIsaac called a meeting with pretty much all of the power brokers in the Blackhawks organization, the coach, the GM, a lot of behind-the-scenes people as well.
Several witnesses recalled and later told others about a discussion that then ensued during the meeting regarding whether the time was right to address the allegations against Aldrich in light of the ongoing playoffs.
And now, according to this investigation, the reports of all these men vary significantly of what happened in that meeting. But the most important thing is that Brad Aldrich remained on the staff.
The Hawks are going to the Stanley Cup Finals.
They won a Stanley Cup. He was able to have a day celebrating with the Stanley Cup.
During an evening of celebration, after the Blackhawks' Stanley Cup win the previous day, Aldrich made an unwanted sexual advance towards a Blackhawks intern who was 22 years old at the time.
And then, according to the investigation, the Blackhawks director of human resources met with Aldrich later in June, and they said, you have two options. One, you can resign, or you can do an investigation. He chose to resign.
A former volunteer coach with the Houghton High School hockey team has been sentenced on a fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct charge.
And, you know, the most disturbing aspect about this is that 3 years later in 2013, Aldrich was convicted in Michigan of fourth-degree criminal sexual assault involving a high school student.
Wow.
And he was sentenced to 9 months in prison, 5 years of probation, and he's now on Michigan's Registry of Sex Offenders.
What are the Blackhawks saying about their handling of this thing? Because should he have had that job for the next several months or whatever? Should he have just been allowed to resign without the cops ever being made aware?
You know, I think today there's a reckoning of how they handled it at the time.
It is clear that in 2010, the executives of this organization put team performance above all else. John Doe deserved better from the Blackhawks.
You'll see there's a lot of fallout from this. The GM of the team, who was an architect of their three Stanley Cup winning teams, Stan Bowman, resigned.
We and he ultimately accept that in his first year as general manager, he made a mistake alongside our other senior executives at the time and did not take adequate action.
That man I told you about, Al McIsaac, the senior team official, resigned. There's no more executives from that 2010 team. And something that I think is important here is that the team released the report, and it is really detailed and it's really graphic.
The Blackhawks' own sexual harassment policy, which required investigation of all reports of sexual harassment to be conducted promptly and thoroughly, was violated.
And I do think that it sets a new level for transparency in issues like this, because as disturbing it as it is to read, it's really important to understand what happened and the missteps that happened so that it doesn't happen again.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm wondering, Emily, is what this means going forward for NHL fans, for NHL players that might, you know, when you hear about sexual assaults in sports, you think, oh, that's somewhere else, or that's some other type of athlete, not here with these men in the NHL.
Absolutely. And I think there's also a general misunderstanding of what sexual assault is or sexual misconduct is.
We talk a lot about hockey culture.
When I'm reading through the report, there's some really disturbing notes in there. For example, John McDonough, who was the team president, apparently when he was made aware of this alleged encounter, he found it incredulous that this video coach was 5'6". How could he have a non-consensual relationship with this player who was far bigger, far stronger? Like, that just couldn't happen. And obviously we know that's not the case. Body size, gender, sexual assault doesn't discriminate against any of those factors, but the fact that he believed it and the fact that he said it out loud, I think, is really troublesome.
We must and will do better.
Right. Like you said, Aldrich is denying that anything non-consensual happened during his time with the Blackhawks. In the meantime, one of those executives that allegedly heard about the allegations and did not contact the police, Stan Bowman, has now resigned his new position at USA Hockey ahead of the Beijing Olympics. Emily Kaplan from our partners at ESPN. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take one more break. When we return, even if your band broke up long ago, the talk is still ticking. One Last Thing is next. And One Last Thing.
Hey, mama said the way you move.
In the music world, it's no longer about album sales. Hasn't been for a while. The Stairway to Heaven is all about streams on Spotify, on Apple. But yesterday, the band Led Zeppelin inked a new deal with a different streaming service. They uploaded their entire music catalog to TikTok. Andrea, why do it now? Like, does TikTok even make these bands money?
From what I've read, TikTok does pay a small royalty. It's like 10ths or 20ths of a penny or a cent.
That's Andrea Dresdale from ABC Audio's entertainment unit.
Based on the number of creations, it doesn't even have to go viral.
She says, sure, Zeppelin might get some cash from some kids lip-syncing somewhere. They might even get a lump sum from TikTok for joining. But that's not the real play.
It's all part of a strategy of how can we get more music out of this catalog, especially for a defunct band like Led Zeppelin or the Beatles. There's not going to be new music coming out. So what can we do with what we already have?
She says bands have been discovering that TikTok is way more than a video platform. It's a cultural springboard.
Let's rank their albums from worst to best. I could never say enough good about this band.
Zeppelin riffs in 1 minute. Let's go, baby.
And some artists are trying to bounce all their songs off it at once.
Well, there's really two things happening here.
Perfect time, perfect place, perfect song, obviously.
There's what happened with Fleetwood Mac last year, which was one of their songs, which happened to be on TikTok, was picked up and it went viral.
Nathan Apodaca of Idaho says his car broke down and he needed to get to work, so he rode his longboard and recorded himself singing along to Fleetwood Mac while drinking cranberry juice.
And that drove it up the charts, drove the parent album up the charts. And what's happening now, for example, with Led Zeppelin and a few weeks ago with the Beatles, is an act making the conscious decision to release all their songs on TikTok in hopes that people will start using it to create videos. They will go viral. That will drive streams, downloads, perhaps the entire back catalog.
But will teenagers suddenly want to get the lead out just because their music happens to be there? Some of their songs are more than 50 years old. But you might also think ABBA's not particularly cool either. Until you see TikTokers recently using that catalog to make money, money, money. What I like are the songs from 2009 that are being quote-unquote brought back by TikTok. Like, you kids are the only ones who did not know this song existed until this moment. Hey, if you're enjoying the show, whether you're new or whether you're an OG Start Here fan, hit us up with a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening now. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.